in chapter 1.
And
but before
off.
We do that, I want to okay, look at stop. A question okay, from stop. Lesson 1. Okay. Give you a book, expect you to answer the questions. Robert always emphasizes, what's the theme of the book? You should know without looking.
God works in the kingdoms of men.
Okay, God rules in the kingdoms of men. Does it just work? It rules in the kingdom of men. Did Robert say works?
No. Okay. I did. Okay.
God rules in the kingdom of men. Robert suggested in lesson one that you memorize a few key dates. So without looking, what's the approximate date of when Daniel was taken into captivity?
605 BC.
Okay, 606 or 605. People differ on the date exactly. That's right. What's the approximate date that Ezekiel goes into captivity? 597. What's the date when Jerusalem was burned? 586. Okay. When was the approximate date of when Babylon fell? 537? Yeah. You got to remember Jeremiah's 70 years and 606. If you start from 606 or 605 and subtract 70, you get 535, 536. So, yes, those are some easy dates to remember if you know the time spans and a couple of key dates. Good things to remember. Who were the prophets contemporary with Daniel?
Ezekiel
and Jeremiah. That's right. Where did Daniel and Ezekiel live? And to whom did they prophesy? Start with Ezekiel. Where did he live?
Babylon, the river Chebar.
Chebar, yes, in Babylon, yeah. Drainage canal, where you would be farming, slave labor. Daniel served where?
Babylon
and Susa, the capital.
Susa.
So Babylon and Medo-Persian empires, that's right. What circumstances caused Daniel to be taken to Babylon?
He was a noble.
He
was taken with the nobles when they were taken.
Okay. Well, why did they take nobles?
To keep from the uprising.
Bring the crown.
Okay. So the background is Nebuchadnezzar had come down and battled with Pharaoh Necho at Carchemish, and of course Israel was trying to ally itself with Pharaoh Necho. They were in rebellion to Babylon. And so when Nabopolassar died about that time, Nebuchadnezzar was called back to Babylon to ascend to the throne, and it's when he goes back, he has been besieging Jerusalem, and he seizes those that might lead a rebellion, the nobles, the king's son, and the nobles, the princes. Right. So, in what two languages is the book originally written?
Aramaic and Hebrew.
Have you given any thought as to why it might be in Aramaic, some of it?
To other people. Written to other people.
Maybe at different times. Robert suggests that that maybe half of the book was written when Daniel was an older man.
Those are things that have been proposed. Something I haven't really heard proposed, but makes a lot of sense to me, is you wonder who Daniel wrote to? Do you think he wrote this purely for the Hebrews?
No.
Remember what we're talking about on Sunday? Jeremiah says God has a controversy with who?
The nations.
The nations. So here's Daniel, and he's got something important to say about nations. Remember the dream? God's going to set up his kingdom. What's that message for? The Hebrews? It's for all men. So if he writes it in Aramaic, guess what? That's a language of that whole broad sweep of the Fertile Crescent. So think about it. You're going to see in chapter 2, about verse 4, when it says, let's see, he responds in Aramaic. The Chaldeans speak to the king in Aramaic. O king, live forever. That's where the text starts in Aramaic. And it goes through chapter 7. And so look as you're reading, because you were supposed to have read the whole book of Daniel mm-hmm. in prep for tonight. So when you go back and read it again, mm-hmm. look at that boundary of chapter 2, verse 4 through the end of chapter 7, and look at what's contained in there, and then compare it to chapters 8 and so forth. And I think you'll see the things from 8 and on are kind of peculiar to focused on the Hebrews. But chapters 2 through 7 really is a message for all men and for kingdoms. So it's an important thing to think about, that it is in portion in Aramaic. What are the four major objections to its authenticity? Number one, it's got miracles in it. If you're an atheist, you cannot accept that. Because if you're an atheist, there is no supernatural power. So there cannot be any miracles. The other is prophecies.
This
is again supernatural. What are the other two?
Languages and historical statements.
Yeah. Languages and historical statements. How did Jesus give credence to the fact that Daniel was inspired?
Jesus said he was a prophet.
Yeah. He said, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken about by Daniel the prophet, you know it's time to leave. So, if you don't accept Daniel as a prophet, can't accept a Messiah who's obviously deluded either. So it's important to us to understand that Daniel really is a prophet. What makes a miracle distinct from ordinary events is simply something that is beyond the natural. And not just that you can't see how it's done, but it really is beyond the natural. I know some people use the term miracle as, oh, that's a miracle. I don't see how it's done. It's like magic. Turn on your computer and things work. Ooh, it's like magic. Just because you don't understand how it works doesn't mean it's supernatural. But it has to be something that cannot be explained by anybody. And I would say even beyond that, even in future times. Because there are some things today that we understand that we didn't understand 100 years ago that didn't make a miracle 100 years ago just because we didn't know. But it cannot be explained by natural events for any time. How can a study of Daniel be of help to a Christian? It's simple faith building. One of the most powerful evidences we have in the Bible is prophecy. If you read the Quran, and I urge you to, because I think it'll improve your understanding of the Quran and how it's different from the Bible. What's different about the Quran and the Bible?
It's more just a bunch of stories, it's not very coherent.
Sarah? I don't recall. I thought it did. But the big thing that I see is there are no miracles. And there is no prophecy. And therefore there's no witness as evidence that this is the words of God. Muhammad claimed that they were the words of God. But that is lacking the evidence. The Bible has the evidence. And here's the evidence. Daniel is one of the key evidences. Okay, so let's get into, your research. If you did your research, find four places where it says that God rules in the kingdom of men. Chapter
417, 521.
425 and 432. So three times in chapter 4 and once in chapter 5. Okay, so let's get into the text of Daniel chapter 2. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. There's a little bit of controversy about the date there because Daniel says it was clearly in the third year of Jehoiakim. Jeremiah says it was the fourth year. Robert gives you the explanation. There's the, it didn't all come up, did it? Here we go. There's the visual. Daniel is writing from the Babylonian perspective, so he's using the Babylonian method of, you don't count the first year of a king as his first year of his reign, it's his accession year. And so, according to Daniel's reckoning, the fourth year would be the third year Jehoiakim are back in Judah trying to ally themselves with the Egyptians. They're following the Egyptian method of the first year really is the first year. So there's the only difference, and it's not really a conflict. Scholars all recognize that. It's not a problem. And so what's happening is Jehoiakim has rebelled, and Nebuchadnezzar besieged the city, and he took the nobles, and let's read it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand with some of the articles of the house of God, and he carried him to the land of Shinar to the house of his God, and he brought the articles into the treasure house of his God. The king instructed Ashpenaz, the master of the eunuchs, to bring some of the children of Israel and some of the king's descendants and some of the nobles. So, where does Daniel fall in all that?
In verse 6, it says he's of the sons of Judah. But
okay. So he's of the tribe of Judah. Is he of the king's descendants? The text doesn't really tell us. He was either of the king's descendants or one of the nobles. We don't really know for sure which one.
Or according to verse 3, he could have just been one of the children of Israel.
True.
It doesn't necessarily mean he was a noble then.
True. These would be people that would be likely to aid in a rebellion. So if they have money, wealth, influence, power, nobles, princes, kings, descendants, yeah. Somebody with from a family of influence. Young men in whom there was no blemish, but good-looking, gifted in all wisdom, possessing knowledge and quick to understand, who had ability to serve in the king's palace, and whom they might teach the language and the literature of the Chaldeans. Why is it important for the king to have these men trained? How is it to his benefit?
They're the kind of people that could be influential back among their own people.
Okay, that's one. Of course, it's interesting that Daniel never goes back to his own people. Sarah?
Also, with the other thing, that if they taught them their language, then the king could mine them for information.
Exactly. And I think that's the key. If you think Israel is going to, or Judah is going to rebel again, you have men on your staff who can give you insight as to what they might be planning, why they think the way they think. Just like today, if you're going to run a multinational company and you've got a branch in Japan, guess what? You're going to have on your staff people who know Japanese, understand the culture. So that when you go in and you launch your product, you don't give it a name that means something really bad, right? We've all seen those mistakes made. But the point is, you got on your staff people who can advise and who can write letters of influence and other things. And it helps communication both ways. So this is to the king's advantage, and it's obviously to Daniel's advantage well. So the king appoints for them a daily provision of the king's delicacies and of the wine which he drank, 3 years of training for them, so that at the end of that time they might serve before the king. From among those of the sons of Judah were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Now names are interesting here. Robert's got in the book what the names mean. Daniel, notice it ends in E-L. We pointed out Sunday E-L means God. El, short for Elohim. Plural God. You'll notice a lot of the names have IAH on the end. That's the shortened name of Jehovah, Yah. It appears in a couple places in the Old King James. Psalm 68:4 is one of those. And so again, Jehovah or Yah is gracious for Hananiah. Mishael, who is like God, and Azariah, Yah helps. And conversely, when you look at the names that they're given and the verses to come, Belteshazzar, servant of Bel. Shadrach. This is interesting. You don't see it right away, but the A-C-H is short for Aku. Well, the U is dropped when it's at the end, apparently. And so Shadrach and Meshach both end in A-C-H for Aku, the moon god. So Shadrach, the command of the moon god. Meshach, you notice Mishael, Mishach. The first part is the same. Only the last part has changed. So instead of who is like God, it's who is like Aku. And I can only imagine how it would feel to a Hebrew to have your name changed to honor a pagan god instead of the one true God. But this is what's happening here. And Abednego, servant of Nebo. And of course, Nebo was the son of Marduk. Marduk was the primary god of Babylon. Nebo was the prophet for Marduk. So here's just something I found on the web that talks about the moon god. You'll see the moon god with various names, sometimes called Ur, and he was the patron god of Ur. What happened in Ur? Yeah, Abraham came from Ur of the Chaldees, right? Yeah, that's what they were doing back in hometown when Abraham left. Aku, Sin, Agu, those are all similar names given to the moon god. Why do you think... Oh, question.
Maybe I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself, but and maybe you're about to ask this question, if so, I'm sorry. Why do you think it is that the book refers to Daniel by his name throughout the rest of the book, but yet it refers to Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego by their Babylonian names, even though they also followed God and continue to do so?
Good question. I was about to ask you
I'm
that.
I'm sorry.
No, that's fine. No, it's a good question. That. Why? Okay. So, does anybody have any ideas? I can only speculate because it doesn't tell us. Sarah?
Yeah, I thought about that a lot. And later, when at the end, where it actually calls Daniel, I mean, very rarely does it mention calling him Belshazzar, but there at the end, when the woman, the great-grandmother, or whatever.
Yeah, the queen mother.
I believe then, back then she does call him by name, or he's called by that name, and they've kind of forgotten that he was called Daniel. I think maybe it's a situation where he didn't answer to anything except Daniel. I mean, that's... My grandmother told me that she her sister didn't like her first name. She told her, just don't answer when they call you by your first name. Just answer when they call you by your middle name. And it worked.
Rather than that one...
I was going to say, could it be because Daniel's the one writing the book? He refers to himself as Daniel when writing about situations referring to him. But because he's had to learn the language and work with the Chaldeans, he's used to referring to the other three by their Babylonian names.
I think that's part of it. Think about what we talked about earlier. Remember that great big section that's in Aramaic? If he's really writing and trying to address his message to this people, and he refers to these three men by their Hebrew names, they're going to scratch their head and say, who are they? But by referring to them with their names that they would be understood or known as, everybody's going to know who he's talking about when he talks about Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And his message, I believe, in Aramaic, is to the nations.
It's interesting that the idea of language, even because looking at your little printout there, I never knew anything about sin being a god.
Yeah.
It's ironic that that comes down through to us, meaning sin, meaning sin.
It is interesting, isn't it? Some scholars have actually suggested that Mount Sinai, S-I-N-A-I, was a derivative of the sin god. And so some of these pagan names are built into things. Just like today, we don't think a thing about Wednesday, do we?
Wednesday.
Yeah. Thursday. Thursday. All these pagan names, right? Part of history and legacy of culture over the years. But I think that's the key here, is that these three who are going to be publicly brought and tried to be burned in the fire, and that story is going to go forth to all the people about what happens. That story is going to go forth to the nations to talk about these three men and the names they're known by is what's used, because I believe this account was going to be published. At least that's my idea. So let's read on. The king appointed for them a daily provision of the king's delicacies, and to the chief of the eunuchs he gave these names. Daniel, the name Belteshazzar, and so forth. But Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself. with a portion of the king's delicacies, nor with the wine which he drank. Therefore he requested the chief of the eunuchs that he might not defile himself. Now the question I have to ask here is, how does these four men come from the nation of Judah, which is thoroughly corrupt, and they have high standards? You ever thought about that? How is that? Jeremiah chapter 5, verse 1, Jeremiah is called to run to and fro through the streets of Jerusalem, see if you can find a man, if there is anyone who executes judgment, who seeks the truth, and I will pardon her. Some have taken that to say there wasn't a single solitary man in Jerusalem that was righteous. I've got a problem with that, because I know about Jeremiah, and there were others. I believe that's a hyperbolic statement, but it shows that overwhelmingly there's a problem. What you see is, in Ezekiel, he says, even if these three men, Noah, Daniel, and Job, were in it, they would only deliver themselves by their righteousness. So if it was just find one, well, if he could find one, would he save it? No, I believe it's a hyperbolic statement. Kind of like today, if you want to know the pulse of how the people are feeling, what do? News people take their microphones, and where do they go?
Man on the street.
Man on the street, right? Run to and fro where? Through the streets. I think he's saying, feel the pulse of the nation. It's wicked. I think it's a hyperbolic statement. What you see in Ezekiel is that when the Lord's presence goes to leave from the temple area, he says, go through the midst of the city, through the midst of Jerusalem, and put a mark on the foreheads of the men who sigh and cry over the abominations that are done in it. You mean there were some in Jerusalem that did not like what was going on? That's right. God knows who they are, and they're marked for God's preservation. Interestingly enough, when you look at these last days, what you see is there are two key families that we know about, and there may have been more. The families of Shaphan and Hilkiah. Shaphan was called the scribe, and it was to him as a manager the responsibility to have the temple renovated. And so he takes the money that's been collected and he goes to Hilkiah the priest and says, take care of it, here's the money. So when Hilkiah finds the book of the law of the Lord, what does he do with it? He takes it to the manager, Shaphan, the scribe, and Shaphan takes it to the king. What you see is a lineage of these two guys, and what you see is a family, kind of like what Proverbs says, I believe, children are like arrows, and blessed is a man that has a quiver full. These men had children, and they had a significant influence on them. So what you find is, when the king wants to inquire, what do we do now that we found the book of the Lord, who does he send? Well, he sends Hilkiah and Ahikam, the son of Shaphan, and Shaphan the scribe as well. And they go inquire of the Lord. It's Ahikam, here in verse 24 of Jeremiah 26, that was with Jeremiah and defended him so they would not put him to death. Who's Ahikam? Shaphan's son. When it comes time that Jeremiah wants to send a letter, now Jeremiah is not on the king's good list. How is he going to get a letter all the way over to Babylon? There's no post office he can just drop it in. What does he do? Well, there's Elasa, the son of Shaphan, and Jemariah, the son of Hilkiah. These two are faithful men. They are ambassadors for the king, and they take Jeremiah's letter. You don't do that unless you truly believe that Jeremiah is who he says he is, because there's great personal risk in doing this. It's Jemariah, the son of Shaphan, who provides a chamber in the temple from which the scroll of Jeremiah can be read. It's Jemariah, the son of Shaphan, who, along with the princes, recognizes Jeremiah's life is in danger and says, when Jeremiah's scroll is read before them and they know it's going to go to the king, go hide yourself. The king will kill you. Go hide. And Gedaliah, that's made governor after the city's been burned, who's Gedaliah? Well, he's the son of Ahikam, the son of Shaphan. And ultimately, who is it that helps come back and rebuild? It's Ezra. Who's Ezra? The son of Sariah, the son of Azariah, the son of Hilkiah. So you see this legacy of these two men that are trying to live righteous lives and their children. So when Daniel comes on the scene with his three friends and they have these high standards, where does it come from? We don't know. But it could be a result of godly men and godly women who have trained them, even in wicked times. Now, just like we send our kids off to college, it's not sure what's going to happen in college. You give a child a trained faith, it becomes different when they see the person next to them come back to the dorm room drunk and on drugs and just destroying their lives and self-destructing, and they, you know, start thinking, you know, what mom and dad told me was right. Here's Daniel, think about it. He had probably heard the words of Jeremiah. I mean, if he's among the nobles and the princes, and Jeremiah's been talking and preaching, he's going to hear the words. And Jeremiah's been saying, God has commanded destruction because this nation has gone after idols. And now the first part has happened. The siege has happened. He's been taken. He's now in a foreign land. Do you think it becomes more important to him whether you worship an idol or not? You know, as a child growing up, 10, 12, 13, it might have been easy to say, you know what, the idols are no big deal. All the nations do them. Everybody in town's doing them. There's one at the end of every street. You know, what's the big deal? What's the harm? And now all of a sudden the words of Jeremiah are coming through. I'm convicted. I really think that's part of it. No matter what he's been trained, he's seen a conviction. And so now when he's presented with, do I defile myself? Is it important? Yeah, I believe it's very important because he sees the conviction. So what does it mean that to defile himself with these delicacies of the king? Nobody knows. What are the possibilities?
Not kosher food?
Not kosher meaning not according to the law, which means it might have been strangled. The blood hadn't been properly drained. Possible. Could be unclean. Could be pork, yes. Those are the keys that I think of. It's not important that we know how. It's important to know that Daniel was convicted that this was wrong. And to defile himself, I believe, means to be a transgression of God's law. That's the way I take it. I don't take it to mean, oh, you know, I'm a health nut and that's fat. You know, fat can have bad cholesterol. You know, it's probably just not good for me. You know, I really don't want to do that. No. I think when he says defile him, I think he's talking about transgression of God's law. So this is a matter of personal conviction. And so he goes to the Daniel purpose in his heart, that he would not defile himself with a portion of the king's delicacies, nor with the wine which he drank. Therefore he requested of the chief of the eunuchs that he might not defile himself. God had brought Daniel into the favor and goodwill of the chief of the eunuchs. We don't know how, but God worked. And the chief of the eunuchs said, I fear the king who has appointed your food and drink. For why should he see your faces looking worse than the young men who are your age? It would endanger my head before the king. So Daniel proposes a test. He says to the steward over the chief of the eunuchs, set over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Remember, this part's still in Hebrew, so he's using the Hebrew names right there. Please test your servants for 10 days and let them give us vegetables to eat and drink, water to drink. Then let our countenances be examined before you and the countenances of the young men who eat the portion of the king's delicacies. And as you see fit, so deal with your servants. So he consented with them in this matter and tested them 10 days. At the end of 10 days, their countenance appeared better and fatter in flesh than all the young men who ate the portion of the king's delicacies. Thus the steward took away the portion of delicacies and the wine they were to drink and gave them vegetables. I don't know that 10 days on a vegetarian diet would make that big a difference. But remember, God's working in this person to show favor. And he perceived favor, and that worked for these young men's benefit. And so for these four young men, God gave them knowledge and skill in all literature and wisdom, and Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. And at the end of the days, when the king had said that they should be brought in, the chief of the eunuchs brought them in before Nebuchadnezzar. The king interviewed them, and among them all, none was found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Therefore they served before the king, and in all matters of wisdom and understanding about which the king examined them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and astrologers which were in his realm. Thus Daniel continued until the first year of King Cyrus. I think Robert points out that he really served as statesman to the king beyond that, but he only served for the kings of Babylon up to the first year of Cyrus. But he is prophesying beyond that point in time. Any questions about what we read? It's a pretty simple text, but there's a lot there in a sense. The real question, or the real thing that we need to understand is why Daniel acts as he acts, and why it's important. I think that was the end of my slides, but here's some questions. What's the source of their conviction? Could be family values, could be friends, could be simple observation that it does make a difference. Robert asked a question in the study questions. Look at the thought question on page 10. Are we ever tempted like Daniel? Pardon?
Put to the test like that? Is that what you mean by tempted?
That's Robert's question.
What do you think Robert means by that question?
Well, it's open for discussion. And I'm interested in what you think it means. Are we ever tempted like Daniel? Well, let's talk about how Daniel was tempted. He was tempted to transgress what he perceived to be God's commands, because he purposed not to defile himself. So apparently, he was put in a position where he was being told, this is what you have to do.
I can give you an example.
Okay.
When I was growing up, my parents never let me go on field trips overnights for school or anything because I wouldn't get out of it over a weekend because I wouldn't be able to go to church. So when my kids were in high school and there was a trip planned to New York, I was on the committee and all the boosters and all that stuff and everything. And I said, yes, I'll be a chaperone. I'll raise enough money to send him and me, and I did.